From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. A new DVD features a 1979 performance of the late singer Dusty Springfield in concert live at the Royal Albert Hall. On today's Fresh Air, we hear from her biographer, Vicki Wickham. She was also Springfield's friend and manager. Also, music critic Milo Miles reviews a batch of DVDs that document early punk music. And we remember the great tap dancer Fayard Nicholas, who died earlier this week at the age of 91. He and his younger brother Harold were part of the famous Nicholas Brothers. They got their start as kids dancing at the Cotton Club in Harlem. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross.
Dusty Springfield!
Some critics consider Dusty Springfield the best British female rock singer of the 60s. She had many hits in England and America, including Wishin' and Hopin', I Only Want to Be With You, I Just Don't Know What to Do With Myself, and The Look of Love. A CD and DVD of her 1979 performance at the Royal Albert Hall, with Princess Margaret in attendance, has recently been released. From that concert, here's one of her biggest hits. That's an excerpt from Dusty Springfield Live at the Royal Albert Hall, which has just come out on CD and DVD. Springfield died of cancer in 1999, just before her 60th birthday. Springfield's authorized biography, Dancing with Demons, described the personal life that few of her fans knew about, including the fact that she was a lesbian. In 2002, Terry Gross spoke with the book's co-author Vicky Wickham, who was Springfield's longtime friend and manager. Wickham produced the British TV music program Ready, Steady, Go, which Springfield appeared on and later co-hosted. And she also co-wrote one of Springfield's hits, You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. Vicky Wickham met the singer when Springfield made a guest appearance on Ready, Steady, Go.
It was a chaotic show which went out every week on Associated Rediffusion Television, which was the independent channel, and it was subtitled The Weekend Starts Here. And we were a mixture of music, fashion, the celebrities of the time, pop art. And you have to remember, this was 1963. It was The Who, The Beatles, later Jimi Hendrix, The Animals. And we started bringing in American artists, Ike and Tina Turner, James Brown, Otis Redding. And it was live. It started off as a mimed show, but within a year went live. And every single week, we never quite got it right. It was a live in studio with an audience. And the cameras, I mean, literally would go between dancers, between the audience. And it just caught people's imagination. And kids would literally run home from school to see the show.
Yeah, it was kind of like American Bandstand, but with fashion and more interviews and things like that.
Yes, exactly. It's exactly what it was.
I mean, it's amazing. Like in the early days of Ready, Steady, Go, you know, the Beatles would come on and then Ringo would dance in the audience with the other dancers.
Yeah. Exactly, which, you know, was amazing because they were huge at the time.
Right. Dusty Springfield is really an extraordinary singer. And, you know, I grew up listening to her records and, you know, I always liked her, but it was as an adult that I could really appreciate what a truly good singer she is. What struck you about her singing when you were auditioning people for Ready, Steady, Go?
She had a sound, and there are very few people that have a real sound to their voice. And Dusty's just one of those lucky ones that, you know, she's recognizable anywhere. She had an impeccable choice of material. She knew exactly what was right for her voice.
Her first hit, I Only Want to Be With You, came out in 1964 and debuted on Ready, Steady, Go. And this was while you were producing the program. What did you think of the record then? Did you think that was the right choice for her?
Yes, absolutely. It was a wonderful song and a great way to launch her.
Why don't we hear it?
Doesn't matter.
Dusty Springfield's first hit, I Only Want to Be With You. My guest is Vicki Wickham, who co-wrote Dancing with Demons, the authorized biography of Dusty Springfield. You actually co-wrote one of Dusty Springfield's songs, You Don't Have to Say You Love Me, which was released in 1966. How did you come to co-write the song, and tell us if there's a story behind it?
Well, there is. Dusty had been at the San Remo Song Festival and came back with an Italian song that each time she was going to record, she'd say, I must write lyrics to it. She never did, so she never recorded it. And it came to the time in 64 where she said, I really need to record this song. And I, like a big mouth, said, well, any fool can write lyrics. So she said, well, okay, if any fool can write lyrics, go and write lyrics. And luckily, I was having dinner that night with a friend of mine. Actually, I was having dinner with him every night because we used to see each other all the time, Simon Napier-Bell, who was a musician. And I said to Simon, before we go to dinner, we have to do these lyrics for Dusty because she's recording tomorrow. So he said, okay, you know, play me the song. So we sat and played, and of course we sat and argued about what it should be and what it shouldn't. But it really, in about 30 minutes, we'd got the basis of it and then finished it off in the taxi. And the next day, when I was typing them up for Dusty, I called Simon and I said, these are horrible. I cannot give these to Dusty. And he said, well, what are you going to do? So I said, I suppose give them to Dusty because there's no choice. Like, so I think I sent them through or sent them over to Dusty or dropped them off or something. And she said, these are really bad. And I said, I know, we know that. Anyway, she recorded it. And of course, it went to number one.
Why did you think they were so bad, the lyrics?
They're really inane. And if you look at the lyrics, I think the word left is in there about six times. Although, you know, when you become familiar with them, you think, okay, they're not perhaps not so bad.
So, well, why don't we hear the song and we'll let everybody judge what they think of the
okay.
lyrics. It certainly did well for her and for you. That's You Don't Have to Say You Love Me, a 1966 hit by Dusty Springfield. My guest Vicki Wickham co-wrote the lyrics. She also co-wrote Dusty Springfield's biography called Dancing with Demons. Now, as you were getting to know Dusty Springfield, something that you learned about her was that she was a lesbian, and this was at a time when virtually no performers were really out of the closet, certainly not in pop music. How did you find out about that?
Well, because we were friends, so we were hanging out together. We, you know, had some of the same friends. We were beginning to have our own friends. And, you know, obviously, you know, you know what your friends are doing.
And are you gay too?
Yes, absolutely.
Did you have to keep each other's secrets? Did it need to be as big a secret for you as it was for her? Because you weren't a performer and could maybe afford to be a little more open.
Well, exactly. For me, it was never a problem because I wasn't in the public eye. And, I was always openly gay and it was absolutely fine. But for somebody like Dusty, it did matter. I mean, it was absolutely unheard of in 63, in the early 60s. And I really do think it would have harmed her at the time had people really known. You have to remember, too, the press in England, it's got worse over the years, but they're very intrusive. I mean, there are a lot of tabloids. As you know, we have about six or seven daily papers and then all the Sunday papers. So they need something to write about. And the more sensational it is, the better. The bigger name you are, obviously, the bigger story. And it was a real worry that, you know, the papers would start splashing it across.
And did people in the industry know and just keep it quiet, or were they clueless about it?
I think they mostly didn't know, and the few that did, you know, they weren't really particularly interested either. They were too busy with their lives. Mm-hmm. You know, your contemporaries don't care. It's really only the press and then the general public.
Dusty Springfield was from a Catholic family. She went to convent school. Did she feel guilty about her own sexual orientation?
Yes, she did. She felt guilty about a lot of things, and I think that the Catholic faith throughout her entire life always was a burden to her, and that was a large part of what the big problem was.
As a producer of Ready, Steady, Go, were you ever concerned that if she was outed, it would be a problem for the program?
No, not remotely. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it would have been. The only problem we ever had with Ready, Steady was when Donovan was busted for pot, and there was a whole discussion about whether we should have him on. I mean, how inane that sounds now, but that was the biggest problem we ever had.
Vicki Wickham, friend and biographer of the late Dusty Springfield, speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Vicki Wickham, friend and manager of the late Dusty Springfield.
Dusty Springfield really had a look in the 60s when she became a star. Why don't you describe the kind of fashion she wore, how she did her eyes, her hairdos?
Dusty had this huge bouffant hairdo, which required a lot of back combing and a lot of spray, which we would sometimes laugh and say that she was responsible alone for the ozone layer. She also wore a lot of makeup. She looked at the fashion magazines and the film magazines of the time and would look at people like Monica Vitti, I suppose like a Bardo, that type of thing, and she followed their eye makeup, which was a lot of black, like a panda makeup with a lot of heavy eyeliner above the lid as well as below. And dress-wise, she was what in those days was called a mod. You had mods and rockers, and Dusty was a mod with short skirts and skimpy little tops. I mean, she was very fashionable. You know, kids would emulate her.
Dusty Springfield recorded several Burt Bacharach, Hal David songs, such as I Just Don't Know What to Do with Myself, Wishing and Hoping, The Look of Love. How did she start to do Bacharach?
Dusty used to listen to a lot of demos from America. Publishers would send her demos. And, of course, she was going backwards and forwards to America to appear on shows, package shows, like at the ones at the Brooklyn Fox, where she would be on with Marvin Gaye, Martha and the Vandellas, The Searchers, The Animals, Dusty. So she was very conscious of American music. And she and I and Vic Billings, her manager at the time, went to Paris, and at the Olympia in Paris went to see Dionne Warwick, the Shirelles, little Stevie Wonder, who was singing Fingertips at the time. And she met Dionne Warwick, and we came back with heaps of records. So inevitably, a lot of those, of course, were Bacharach and David. In fact, all of them were Bacharach and David.
And she liked the songs and wanted to start recording them herself?
Loved the songs, yes.
So did she get in touch with Bacharach?
Yes. And I think that Bert, I mean, feels that her version of Look of Love is still the ultimate.
What do you think of her recording of that?
I think it's wonderful. I think it captures every essence of the song. It's beautiful.
Why don't we hear it?
The look of love is in your eyes. The look your heart can't disguise. The look this world. Yeah.
That's Dusty Springfield singing The Look of Love, which was from the film Casino Royale and was another big hit for her. The song was by Bacharach and David. Dusty Springfield did at least one of the songs that Dionne Warwick did as well. Dionne Warwick also did I Just Don't Know What to Do with Myself. Did Dusty Springfield feel competitive with Dionne Warwick when it came to doing Burt Bacharach songs?
No, I think she loved Dionne's voice. She respected Dionne. She actually became friends with Dionne. I think she could have been slightly jealous that Dionne got the songs first from Burt and Hal, because of course Dionne was doing their demos and had first, you know, crack at the songs. But no, I don't think there was actually competitiveness, because Dusty would only do a song if she could do it her way, which she always did.
And do you know if Dionne Warwick felt competitive with Dusty Springfield?
Again, I don't think competitive is the right word. I would think pissed was the right word. I mean, if I were an American and had a great record and had success in the charts in America, and then some English bird was copying it and having success in England, I wouldn't be too happy.
Do you think Dionne Warwick saw it as copying her records?
Yes, I'm sure she did.
In the new authorized biography of Dusty Springfield, you write about her depressions. You say she was diagnosed as manic depressive, and her depressions were sometimes very severe. What was she like on either end of her mood swings?
She could go into the blackest moods ever, and very irrational in terms of nothing was right, nothing was good enough, including herself. Just really deep depressions, which would last sometimes for minutes, and it usually resulted in damaging some innate object of some sort. Never a danger to anybody else or at that point herself. And then on the other end, you know, when she'd come out of them, she was the most intelligent, wonderful, funny, interesting, up person imaginable. I mean, it's hard when she was her normal self, it was hard to imagine that she could possibly be any other way.
She also mutilated herself. She cut on her arms and legs. I think much more is known about that kind of self-mutilation now than was known then. It seems either more common or at least more publicly discussed. How did she and her doctors deal with it? And I don't know whether this was mostly in the 1960s or 70s.
It was both. At the time, you're right, I mean, not that much was known about it. And The biggest thing that I think was a mistake, and I mean, she felt the same way, she never found any help for it, meaning a shrink, a therapist. You know, the British are very anti that type of thing, especially in the 60s and 70s. I mean, we all felt that a good cup of tea would solve everything rather than going to talk to somebody. And of course, now we know better that, you know, it does help to have some professional advice and professional help. And at the time, nobody was really doing that. Even in terms of medication, none of the doctors were really prescribing anything, which nowadays, I don't know if it's Prozac or what they would give you, but they would give you something to help you get through it. At the time, nobody was doing that. So it became an occurrence which would happen far too frequently. And, you know, like with anything like that, it's a cry for help, and nobody was helping.
How did you find out about the cutting?
Various phone calls from emergency rooms or, you know, calls in the night from somebody or from Dusty herself. And, you know, it just, again, you know, none of us were qualified to help. You can offer support, you can, you know, help on that level, but it wasn't obviously enough.
Would the scars or the cuts show when she wore the kind of clothes she liked to wear? You know, was she in risk of performing with cuts and scars showing?
Yes, absolutely. And if you notice, she almost always, in fact, always would wear long sleeves.
And that's why?
Yes.
Vicki Wickham, the friend, manager, and biographer of the late Dusty Springfield, speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more of their interview in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Franz Kafka's Metamorphosis, available in stores and online at bn.com. From Wellington Management, providing investment management for clients worldwide. And from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide. On the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we remember the great tap dancer Fayard Nicholas, who was part of the famous Nicholas Brothers. He died earlier this week at 91. Music critic Milo Miles reviews a number of DVDs which capture early punk music. And we'll hear more of our interview with Vicki Wickham about the late singer Dusty Springfield. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Vicki Wickham, co-author of Dancing with Demons, the authorized biography of Dusty Springfield, the British pop singer of the 60s who had such hits as Wishin' and Hopin', The Look of Love, I Only Want to Be With You, and Son of a Preacher Man. Springfield died of cancer in 1999. Vicki Wickham was her friend and manager. When we left off, they were talking about Springfield's problems with depression.
Would the depression go away when she was on stage?
It's interesting you should say that. Absolutely. Dusty, as much as she hated getting on stage, was scared stiff about it, once she got on stage, was A, the true professional, was absolutely wonderful, and thoroughly enjoyed herself.
Did you ever have to convince her to get on stage?
Constantly. It was always an uphill battle. I mean, as a manager, it really was very depressing sometimes that you'd have these wonderful offers, and I'd call her up and I'd say, okay, you know, this is what somebody wants you to do. Here are the pros, here are the cons. This is what the money is. This is what I, you know, should be. Let's talk about it. And it would always be no. Then I would get a call sort of 15 minutes later or 20 minutes later. Okay, you know, tell me more. What about? What if? And she would always come. She was wonderful, actually. She'd come up with a huge list of, we should ask them this, that, and the other, which is, you know, absolutely the right thing to do. And we would ask them this, that, and the other, and we'd go backwards and forwards. And then it would always be, I don't think I'm ready to do it at the moment. Let's think about it next time. And so during the time I was managing her, she did very, very few performances, a few, televisions, recording, but not live performances.
Do you think that she would forget how much she enjoyed being on stage?
Yes, I do. I think the effort to get on stage outweighed the pleasures or the remembrance of the pleasures when she was on. Having to put on the makeup, the clothes, the hair, having to be scrutinized, it just became too much effort. And I actually do understand it. I think that she should have overcome it, and we all tried to help her overcome it and make it as pleasurable as possible. And when she was doing a television, there would be a team, Debbie Dennell, who did her makeup, whoever was doing her hair, Pat, myself. I mean, a whole group of us would, be around so that we could have some fun, we could have a giggle, we could make it as light and easy as possible. But at the end of the day, it was still Dusty that had to get herself together.
When did Dusty Springfield find out that she had cancer?
She called me up one day and said, at the end of the conversation, sort of very casually said, "Did I tell you that I found a lump in my breast?" To which I said, "No." "And what did your doctor say?" To which she said, "I don't really have a doctor. I haven't been to see anybody." I said, "Dust, get off the phone. Let me make you an appointment with mine. I'll call you right back." So I called my doctor, called her right back. 2 days later, we were in my doctor's office, and the doctor said, basically to all of us, "Yes, there is a lump. I want you to go and see Ian Smith at the Marsden." And we came out, and of course, there was the usual crowd of us, and went and had our usual cup of tea and said, "Well, it could be worse. At least, they know the lump's there. Perhaps they can do something. They're sending you to a great specialist." And we were all trying to be, incredibly optimistic. But of course, when she went to the Marsden, they said, "Yes, it is cancer. We need to shrink the lump," which they did. And then they do what they call is a lumpectomy, which they take the actual lump out. And at that stage, it hadn't spread into the glands or anything. Did chemo, did some radiation, and we thought she was clear, which was magnificent. So the record came out, did all the promotion, which must have been grueling for her, but, thinking that she was absolutely okay. And then she went for a holiday in Ireland and started, strange, having some sort of cough. And when she came back, went back to check, and they said, "Yep, it's come back, and we need to be more aggressive this time around."
And so she took more aggressive chemo after that?
She did. And also, Dusty was a very well-informed person. And what she didn't know, she certainly would find out. She went to every possible source on the internet, friends, et cetera, to find out what treatment was effective, what could be done, what America was doing. Called several people in America and in hospitals and stuff and said, "This is what I'm doing at the Marsden. Is there anything you would recommend?" Just was really well informed, and to their credit, the Marsden were wonderful and tried a couple of things that hadn't been approved in England. They actually went to the association and got approval to use the drugs on Dusty, which was very brave and good of them, because I do think it's your choice what you want. But unfortunately, none of them did the trick.
How did she handle the news that the cancer had come back?
Scared as hell, as we all would be. But absolutely determined that she would beat it. She felt she was in great shape emotionally, just in her life in general, and that she would beat it.
Did she ever, by the way, come out as a lesbian?
No.
Even when she knew she was dying?
No. There was no, in a way, there was sort of no interest in her. From that point of view, at that stage, the papers were interested in the cancer, and it never really cropped up.
Did she wish, do you think, that she could have been more honest about herself?
Yes, because she was a very outgoing person. She wasn't a secretive person at all. I'm quite sure that she wished she could have been.
You were at her funeral when she died?
Yes.
What was the funeral like, and was there any of her music that was played there?
Yes, I put it together with Simon Bell, the two of us, and I just said to Simon, Dust was such a star and artist, we have to just have a very grand funeral. And as the body was put in an open horse-drawn carriage, which has stopped the traffic in Henley. And yes, it was all her music we played. Going Back, which is very apt, a Goffin and King song. And the coffin actually went out to You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. And as it came out of the church, the crowd outside, I'm only laughing because she would have loved it, broke into applause. And Elton said, it's the only funeral I've ever heard of that the coffin gets the applause. She would have definitely been chuffed and had a giggle.
Vicki Wickham, friend and manager of the late Dusty Springfield, speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. She co-authored Springfield's authorized biography titled Dancing with Demons. Dusty Springfield's 1979 concert performance at the Royal Albert Hall has been recently released on CD and DVD. Coming up, Milo Miles on DVDs that document early punk music. This is Fresh Air. The heyday of punk was over by the first year of the Reagan administration. The music industry has changed so much since then that punk can seem especially buried in the past. But critic Milo Miles says that the music lives and thrives on DVD, if you know where to look.
It may seem strange, outstanding documentaries have been made about classic punk bands like the Sex Pistols and the Ramones. But when you think about it, the ferocious punk sound is still vital. And most important, many punk pioneers had tremendous visual clout. The whole idea was to be anything but bland or beautiful. Now even obscure punk singles have been reissued, and their box sets devoted to punk. Likewise, fans and newcomers alike can explore the roots and branches of punk on DVDs. The most ambitious DVD release last year was Punk Attitude by Don Letts. The documentary attempts to tell the whole story of punk, though the narrative becomes sketchy after the middle 1980s. It does offer vibrant coverage of the 70s beginnings and the explosion of UK punk. No surprise, since Letts was a potent DJ on the scene and managed the groundbreaking female group, The Slits. He filmed many of the bands in their prime and gets a host of fascinating, articulate new interviews. Here's filmmaker Jim Jarmusch explaining the charisma of The Clash's Joe Strummer.
Strummer thought of the world and the potential of music as like a, you know, he's always making references to radio broadcasts and, you know, this one's going out to the world. He had that kind of Woody Guthrie thing, or a kind of thing that Dylan had and Bob Marley had and sometimes John Lennon had, where they were aware of that power, but they weren't egotistical about it. And he had this sense, and he knew, and it was true, that something he would think of in his basement in Ladbroke Grove had the potential of affecting, you know, young people particularly, all over the planet.
Know your rights.
The film makes clear that one liberating aspect of punk is that everybody gets to make up a definition of what it means. Anything but safe and conformist. Henry Rollins is as funny and entertaining as I've ever seen him when he takes his shot at the meaning of punk.
So there's always been culture that's being suppressed because it's seen as too dangerous. If there's culture, there's going to be counterculture. If there's going to be people dialoguing, there's going to be culture. You can't escape it. So with culture comes counterculture. Culture seeks to equalize. Nietzsche always said that thieves, they're just trying to even out the playing field, which is interesting. But counterculture will always become culture until the next slapback happens. Late 70s in America, us Americanos, we're getting the English punk rock on import. We're getting Clash, Sex Pistols, the smaller bands but still as good, Lurkers, Adverts, one of the great ones. We're getting Generation X. We're getting all this stuff on import. These bands don't have label deals yet. And then everyone in my neighborhood dropped their skateboards and picked up guitars. And all of a sudden, every friend of yours is in a band.
Does punk attitude leave out important periods and performers? Of course. Letts knows he had too little on Los Angeles punk and includes a worthwhile short film by Dick Rude on the L.A. scene. Besides, a thorough history would probably be too long to enjoy, and Letts has set the standard for punk overview anyway. Film can also enhance the legacy of punks that never found their full audience or recorded frequently enough. From 1973 to 1976, the photographer Bob Gruen and his wife Nadja Beck shot some 40 hours of the New York Dolls performing and clowning around backstage and on the street. Now it's been turned into a rough band bio called All Dolled Up. The Dolls were punk when it was all attitude and impulses, before it became a concept and then a set of rules. Here's singer David Johansen explaining how the Dolls expanded on the rock and roll of the past.
Like the last wave of rock and roll was like, mostly it was in San Francisco. And it was, it had a definite purpose. I mean, the enfranchisement of certain people to become united under a certain kind of music. That's what rock and roll has always been. And this form of music just kind of represents the next generation, like the under 21 kind of people relate to this music. It's like their own music. The basic difference is that as far as like our self-liberation is concerned, we had a lot less trouble to go through, because a lot of things that people have to go through to deliberate themselves or deliberate the masses have been done, and we just kind of picked up on where they left off, and we kind of saved a lot of trouble by that. I guess we are a New York phenomenon.
At first, I thought All Dolled Up was too shapeless, but more viewings reveal its engagingly casual flow and structure. Above all, the film proves the Dolls deserved the hype. Their unbeatable fashion wildness is only enhanced by their unpredictable, outrageous personalities. Less documented and less well-known than even the Dolls were the Screamers from Los Angeles. Led in the late 70s by the flamboyant singer Tomata Duplenty, the Screamers never released any official recordings, though they were local sensations. The performance DVD called just The Screamers shows what all the shouting was about. Tomata Duplenty's shouting, anyway. He's a firebrand performer. Hard to believe this DVD is the only available way to hear this band. With no guitars and two synthesizers, the Screamers had their own sound, and you can't stop watching Tomata. He's obviously having the time of his life, proof that punk is also fun. Finally, for the punk diehards, there's God Save the Queen, a punk rock anthology, which includes 19 performance clips, but, weirdly enough, none by the Sex Pistols. There's other weird things. The Iggy Pop performance is wildly anachronistic from a recent tour. And what's up with having an interview with Marky Ramone but no actual music from the Ramones? Still, there are quite a few infectiously crazed performances, such as the Buzzcocks doing Boredom.
What do you want?
DVD lineup mixes bands you have to see to believe, like the Toy Dolls, with non-entities like Vice Squad and Goldblade? Parts of God Save the Queen are cheap and cheesy throwaways. But I like that, because that's punk, too.
Milo Miles writes about music from his home in Cambridge. Coming up, we remember Fayard Nicholas of the famous tap dancing team, the Nicholas Brothers. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Fayard Nicholas, one of the most remarkable dancers ever to light up a screen or stage, died in Los Angeles this week at the age of 91. He and his brother Harold were the featured act at the Cotton Club in Harlem in 1932, when Fayard was 18 and Harold was only 11. Here's a moment from one of their early performances.
How did you come here?
We want to see Major Joe about something.
Are you professionals?
Professionals, nothing. We passed that stage.
Well, what are you?
We're amateurs.
Amateurs?
Yeah, we're the Nicholas Brothers.
Oh, well, what do you do for a living?
Oh, we sell lucky numbers.
Yeah.
Sell lucky numbers?
Uh-huh.
You can't sell lucky numbers over the radio.
Uh-huh.
No, what else do you do?
Oh, we sing. We dance.
All right, let me hear you sing.
Lucky number, oh, dreaming of lucky numbers, hoping that those lucky numbers...
Yeah. After doing vaudeville as children, the Nicholas Brothers went on to perform some of the most remarkable dances in film history, in such movies as Stormy Weather and Sun Valley Serenade. They combined tap dance and acrobatics, flips, spins, leaps, and splits. In one of their famous movie dances, Fayard ran up a wall and landed in a split. Then Harold topped that by running up another wall, coming out in a backflip, and then finally landing in a split. Dancer and actor Gregory Hines once said that if a movie were ever made about the Nicholas Brothers, the performances would have to be computer-generated, because no living dancer could match their moves. Fayard Nicholas shared a Tony Award in 1989 for his choreography in Black and Blue, and the Nicholas Brothers were the subjects of an Academy Awards tribute in 1981 and Kennedy Center honors in 1991. Before we hear a 1985 interview with Harold Nicholas, let's hear a 1937 recording featuring Harold tap dancing and Fayard singing.
If you're feeling low down, 'cause the skies are gray, just wrap your cares in rhythm and dance. Dance your cares away. Give old gloom the showdown, he'll be on his way. Just wrap your cares in rhythm and dance. Oh, dance your cares away. Now I'm here to teach you all how to make your life a song. Just you keep tapping on wood with your feet, and you can't go wrong. Next time you're in trouble, you'll come out okay. Just wrap your cares in rhythm and dance. I'm gonna give you one more chance. Just wrap your cares in rhythm and dance.
That's the Nicholas Brothers, recorded in 1937. Harold Nicholas died in the year 2000. In 1985, Terry spoke with Harold Nicholas about his life and work with his brother Fayard. Harold said that when he and Fayard were growing up in Philadelphia, their parents were performers.
My brother sometimes would play hooky and go to the shows, and that's where he learned to tap dance. That's how he picked it up, from watching the dancers on stage.
Did he just pick it up, or did anyone
teach
him?
Picked it up just like that. And then he came home and said, listen, I'm going to do something for you. I said, what? I'm going to teach you to dance. At the beginning, it was kind of, you know, I said, oh, I can't get this, because I was left-footed, shall we say. I couldn't do a step only on one foot. That's what it was. But one day when I finally learned how to do the time step, which is the basic of tap dancing, you know, I learned how to do that. Then I was home free.
How old were you then?
Oh, mamma mia. How old was I then? I was about five or six, because it was right away. It didn't take us too long to get started, you know, because the minute that our parents saw what we could do, when we showed them a routine that we put together, you know, after I had learned and everything, my brother taught me this routine, we put it together and they looked at us and they said, well, that's it. We're going to quit what we're doing and just manage the boys.
Had you been doing the splits and leaps yet when you were that young?
No, not really. Well, I did splits because I was taking acrobatics from a stage manager where my mother and daddy were working in the theater, you know. I would go there, and he would teach me how to tumble a little bit. So from there, I knew how to do. I was doing the splits and doing backflips, things like that.
Now, you got into the Cotton Club when you were, I think, like 8 years old.
Mm-hmm.
That's really
That's what I'm
young
saying, because,
be
well, I started, he taught me when I was young, and right from there, we started at the Horn and Heart at Kitty Hour, that was, here, you know, here in Philadelphia. And from there, we just popped right on out.
Did the musicians take you under their wing and become father figures?
Well, everyone did. Yeah, the musicians, the people around, and the audiences also, you know, because the stars used to come up, and they used to ask to see us and talk to us, and we were the only ones that could go out actually in the audience and talk to the people, because the people would ask for us. Yeah, because in those days, you know, the blacks couldn't associate with the people. They could work. They worked there and did the show and everything, but they couldn't come out front and sit down and, you know, and talk with the patrons or something like that. But we were allowed to do it, I guess because we were kids also, but we did it.
When did you start really putting in a lot of acrobatics into your dance?
That's when we went to Hollywood. You see this film that's in, that's dancing now. That was one of the first films that we did for 20th Century Fox Studios. And when we went out there, we met a gentleman by the name of Nick Castle, who was a choreographer. And he worked with us for this movie. But basically, that was really our routine that we did in nightclubs and theaters and everything. And after that, we got a contract with 20th Century Fox Studios to do movies. I think so many movies a year, shall we say. And that's when Nick Castle started thinking up all these wild ideas, wild tricks to do.
Were you able to do all of them? Did he come up with some tricks that you tried and you just couldn't?
No, there was never anything, because he wouldn't take no for an answer.
Okay, well let's talk about let me remember which film it was. The one where you run up the wall.
Mm-hmm.
Was it from Down Argentine Way?
No, that was Orchestra Wives.
Okay, yeah,
with Glenn Miller's orchestra. Remember?
Would you describe that sequence for our listeners who haven't seen
that
it?
That particular sequence?
Yeah.
Well, to learn that trick, Nick Castle came and he says, listen, I got an idea. I said, yeah, okay, what is it? Well, Fayard, you see, I want you to run and jump up on the wall. Just jump as high as you can and then jump off into a split. I said, hey, that sounds good. He said, yeah. And Harold, he says, I want you to go on the other side and run up this wall, walk up the wall, turn over, and do a split. I said, you're kidding. He said, no, I'm serious. You can do it. I said, come on, Nick. I mean, you know, why can't I just run and jump like my brother did? I said, no, we got to be different. So he says, don't worry, we'll learn it. And now they got two fellas. This is for learning the trick, you know. They put a belt around me with the straps on the side, you know, ropes on each side, and they held it. He said, now you just go ahead and try it, and the guys will hold it. They won't let you fall. So he said, so I went and I ran and jumped the wall and I, but they held me, you see. I said, you see what I'm telling you? He said, don't, you can do it, he says. I said, keep trying, don't worry about it. Don't you know, forget it. They're going to hold you. Don't think about falling. So I did that for about 3 or 4 times. And Nick Castle went over to the fellas, you know. He said, listen, this time, don't hold him. Let him go. When he goes up the wall, let the rope go. So we're running, and I did it. And I ran up the wall, and I did the 1, 2, 3 walk and turned over and went down into a split. And I come up, and I said, oh, boy, you really held that one good. So the guys were outside somewhere. They said, no, you did it by yourself. I dropped right on my knee. But after that, I had no trouble at all doing it, because I got it out of my system, that was fear, so to speak, you know.
You performed with your brother as a team for years. I mean, from the time that you were like 6 till...
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Truly.
And he's I think, 7 years older than you. Was there a
Just
lot of...
about.
Was there a lot of competition between you both?
No, not really. No, everyone tells me, you know, if I'm doing something by myself and my brother's around, I mean, it's like he's doing it also. Because he's moving and he's, you know, he's my greatest audience, shall we say, you know. If no one else enjoyed what I was doing, he would enjoy it. So there has never been any friction, shall we say, between us, you know.
Harold Nicholas of the Nicholas Brothers recorded in 1985. His older brother, Fayard Nicholas, died Tuesday at the age of 91 at his home in Los Angeles. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies. Let's close with this 1937 recording of Fayard Nicholas singing and Harold Nicholas tapping at the Cotton Club in Harlem.
He could be a great singer, but he hasn't a chance. Every vocal teacher he goes to tells him he ought to dance. He puts so much expression in the songs of romance. Still each vocal teacher he goes to tells him he ought to dance. His obbligato leaves them blotto, and although it sounds sweet, they just yell brutal, it's all futile. Your vocal talent has slipped to your feet. He has studied in Paris with the masters of France, but the masters had him deported. They said he ought to dance.
Support for NPR comes from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. From the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. And from Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. Information at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we look at the differences between Jewish and Christian interpretations of the Bible. A talk with Mark Zvi Brettler, who teaches biblical literature at Brandeis University and is author of the new book, How to Read the Bible. Join us for the next Fresh Air.